met years, you know that I'm a psychotherapist and a sex therapist and the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships. You know, I find that I say this to myself all the time. I surely wish I knew about dating and relationships and love and marriage when I was first starting out, when I was a teenager and even in my early 20s. And actually, it was not until I really started to do a lot of clinical work. And in fact, the truth is that it was really not until I did my research, which culminated in my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, did I actually have clarity about the things that we need to know and, of course, the things that we need to do if we ever, ever hope to find and maintain and sustain a loving relationship with anyone. So for those of you who are actually tuning in for the very first time and you're saying to yourself, gee, what is this book really all about? Well, very quickly, I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut area, and I devised a formula, my famous 10-step formula, that actually teaches all of us how to assess. And, you know, when I say the word assess, people, they look at me. It's not sexy. It's not romantic. It's not lovey-dovey, but it is absolutely critical. So the formula teaches us all how to actually assess and evaluate who is right for us and who is wrong for us before committing to any serious relationships. Because the reality is that we assess every single thing in our lives, our phones, our cars, our computers, our makeup, our lipsticks. And yet when it comes to relationships, and I'm not just talking about love relationships, work relationships, friend relationships, family relationships, we don't tend to want to think about the importance of making sure that the people who we choose to let into our lives are people that are actually good for us versus people who are destructive and really, really toxic. So when I did the research, which culminated in the book, and I have to say, I did the research and the book for my daughter, Jordana, I was hoping that she was going to have something very, very tangible when she grew up and when she started dating and when she would fall in love that would really help guide her in being able to make a really great assessment. Because the fact is, you know, I think about this all the time. Self-help books. We have never, ever had as many self-help books on the market as we do today. And yet I continue to look at the statistics, the divorce statistics, and nothing is changing. Actually, the statistics are going up. I mean, the divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. 67% of couples who are marrying for the second time, they too divorce. And one would hope after marriage number one, marriage number two, that marriage number three would be the lucky charm, but that's not true. The fact is that the divorce rate for third marriages happens to be between 71 and 73%. So we really need to get serious, right? We need to learn some things. And, you know, just in summary, there are three things, and people will say, what do you mean there's only three things that we need to learn and that we have to actually put into practice? But the first thing is that we need to be in a good place ourselves. We need to be solid so that we are not looking at somebody to save us and rescue us like the damsel or the man in distress, so that we need to be truly in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically and be willing to deal with our stuff. We all have stuff. We all have issues. And unless we do, we put ourselves in a very, very vulnerable position where we're not aware of our issues and we look the other way because we want to be loved and we want to fall in love. And yet it is a very, very dangerous track if we are not okay with or without a partner. So that's number one. And number two, we need to get savvy. You know, I think about all the shows and the podcasts and the television shows and the movies and the self-help books that deal with relationships. And yet I find, I mean, I've been practicing now for over 35 years. I find that people are still not, and this is not blaming and this isn't a judgment and it is not meant to be critical, but people are still really not clear. They're not clear at all about the ingredients that need to go into a healthy relationship. And we need that clarity. We really need that clarity if we are going to empower ourselves. And even more importantly, if we are going to keep ourselves safe. And number three is the formula, my 10-step formula. And I was talking to somebody about this a couple of hours ago, and she was saying, gee, I wish I had a guide. Well, you all have a guide if you are willing to read the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, because it is almost like taking me by the hand, and I'm going to show you all the unsexy, all the unromantic things that we all have to look for just to make sure that the person who we think we're in love with, or the person who we would like to be in love with, is actually someone that is good for us. In fact, I think that this book, and believe me, it's not about selling books at all. I think that this book should be a textbook in all schools. And I was thinking, what age? Probably beginning formally at seventh grade. What do you think about that? I mean, how would you like, if you were a parent, to have your children learn about healthy relationships in very, very concrete terms when they were younger? I certainly wish that I had had the opportunity to learn about all of this. I mean, I grew up in an Orthodox family in Winnipeg, Canada, and I went to day school, and nobody ever talked about relationships or sexuality or mental health. And what I'm really excited about is that I am doing some consulting again this year at East Hampton High School in East Hampton, New York, where I have been given the opportunity by the administration and the principal and vice principal to be able to work along the health teacher and integrating some of the material that they're teaching on mental health and relationships and sexuality, you know, bringing in my clinical psychotherapist and sex therapist experience. So beginning in a couple of weeks, I am going back to school in East Hampton High School, and I'm going to be spending typically one day a week interacting directly with the students. So what else do I do when I'm not doing the Ask Speedy show and I'm not seeing patients? Well, I'm the advice columnist for Dance Papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach, and also for the Winnipeg Jewish News and Post. And it's interesting that that was a paper that I grew up with in Winnipeg as a little girl. So there is an Ask Speedy advice column in that paper as well. And even though I was a really shy kid and I didn't have the kind of confidence that has fortunately evolved and developed over the years, I've been an expert guest in national radio and television for a very, very long time. But I think all the things that I do, I love doing the show. I love, in quotes, performing. But I think the thing that brings me the greatest amount of satisfaction is when I'm working directly with patients in my private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. And, you know, I was thinking about it. I mean, I've had an opportunity over 35 years to meet people from every single walk of life. I've treated murderers. I've treated people who've had, you know, serious substance abuse issues, where there's been sexual abuse. But I have to tell you something, and this is something I don't think that I have ever, I was going to say confess, but that I've ever talked about in the media. There is one type of, in quotes, dysfunctional kind of dynamic that I refused to want to deal with, and that is dealing with perpetrators of sexual abuse. And maybe somebody would say that I'm not open-minded enough and that my heart isn't big enough. But for so many years, I have dealt and I've treated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids and adults who were sexually abused. So my loyalty and my heart goes with you. And, you know, obviously, you know, I hope that people who have been committed of crimes, including sexual abuse perpetrators, naturally, I want them to get help. And so many of these people who have become sexual perpetrators were sexually abused by someone in their own lives growing up. And certainly if we're looking at the area of violence, the little children that are born, they're not born violent. And yet so many and the majority grow up in violent homes where they really continue to play out consciously or unconsciously the dynamic that they grew up with, seeking justice, seeking respect, of course, in all the wrong ways. So again, I'm not sure what you think about that, but that is one group that I hope have been able to see good professional help from other clinicians. But fortunately or unfortunately, it is not going to be with me. So what is this show really all about? You know, I've mentioned so many times when Gary Nell and I first met, we were hoping and planning that the Ask Beattie show is going to be a call-in counseling show, because I had hosted a number of SBD call-in counseling shows on major networks. And for a variety of reasons, unfortunately, this typically has not happened. But that does not mean that you cannot call me at 888-874-4888 during the show at any time. I would absolutely love to be sitting in your apartment or in your home as you're listening to the show and be a fly on the wall and wondering, you know, what are you thinking? Are there other areas? Are there other issues? Do you have questions? Do you have comments? You can just disagree. We can debate each other, because the issues that I talk about, I mean, they are really issues that are central to our well-being. So as you know, we talk a lot about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships. And more importantly, it's not just the talk. It's not just the theory. It's not just reporting about what's going on in the news, but it's always about what to do. What do we all have to do? Not just think about. What do we have to learn? What do we have to do to be able to maximize our physical and emotional and psychological and psychiatric well-being despite the stressors of life that we all have to deal with? And nobody, my friends, is immune from the stresses of life. So I adopted this mantra many, many years ago, which is, of course, acknowledge, address, and resolve. We need to be willing to acknowledge, yes, there are issues, there are problems, there are stressors. But then the next step is to be willing to address address every little thing, the minutest things that you find that continue to get in the way of your life and your relationships, and look toward finding resolutions. The perfect resolution absolutely doesn't exist, because we certainly can't change anything that's happened in our past. And so many, if not most, of our problems really begin with our own family of origin. And yet I have found a methodology over the years that really has been very helpful to thousands of people, which really helps people to emotionally process as best as we can what did and didn't happen, that explains our behavior, that explains how well or also explains how badly we are doing with various different areas in our lives. So I invite you to adopt my mantra: acknowledge, address, and resolve as best as we can the things that get in the way of our being able to live a joyful life. And, you know, I say this all the time. I hope that I have been able to convince you that you don't need to do this on your own, and that reaching out to family and friends, good family, good friends, and if need be, professionals, can make our life journey easier and less isolated, alienated, and lonely. So I have a couple of questions for you now that summer is almost over. So I'm going to ask you, summer's almost over. I can hardly believe it's going to be September in a couple of weeks. So how are you doing? And hopefully, you know, you've been able to have a chance to rest and unwind and reset. And I hope that the natural beauty that surrounds us during the summers has really helped to calm some of the chaos and uncertainty that we all experience from time to time, both in our personal and professional lives. And the transition back to a new season of school, work, and life, of more regimented responsibility. Yes, it is going to be more regimented responsibility, is often difficult for many. You know, especially we're living in a world beset by threats of upticks in the viruses, which we're hearing about more and more. War, violence, political and economic upheaval, and ecological devastation, and unimaginable suffering of people around the world. And of course, I'm always looking and researching at mental health statistics. And what we're seeing is that the mental health crisis hitting Americans shows absolutely no sign of abating, with provisional numbers, we're talking 2022, showing suicides by another 2.6% last year. And that follows an overall 5% increase in suicides in 2021, as reported by the United States Centers for Disease Control, CDC. And other social indicators, such as family abuse and alcoholism, rates of interpersonal violence, and many others, show correspondingly high rates. So it makes it all that more important for each of us to figure out ways to nurture ourselves and our relationships amid life's challenges. So we all need to be creative, right? And never give up, to continually find ways to live our lives that are in our best interest. And I know that that's not always easy, and it's not always possible, but it's easy to so easy to just avoid and deny and blame others for our problems. And I think that the ongoing challenge for all of us is to be ready and willing to really step up to the plate and take responsibility, personal responsibility, to deal with our issues that continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships. And we need to get ourselves to a place where we're really up for the task. Because it's exceedingly difficult to change others Unless they want to change themselves. I mean, I say this all the time. We can't change anybody, only ourselves. So that leaves us with our own possibilities and potential for change, something that we actually do have control over. And, you know, again, and I say this over and over and over, that I hope that I have convinced you that we don't need to take this journey on our own. And if your game plan, whatever your game plan is not working, we need to be willing, like professional athletes, to work with the expertise of others who can help develop new and better life strategies, you know, for all of us. You know, my husband, Jim, and I, we were looking at a tennis tournament, the Cincinnati tournament, tennis tournament. And I mean, it's just amazing. You look at the players' boxes and there are managers and there are coaches and there are physical therapy people and mental health people and sports psychology people. And that's true. It takes a village for us to be able to really achieve the maximum potential that we have. And so many people think that, yes, we need to do this on our own. But the truth is that not only can we not do it on our own, it is unnecessary to even be wasting our time thinking that it is somehow a good thing to have a solitary life without the support of family, if you're lucky, and friends, and if need be, professionals. So I have a task for you right now. It's time for your self-assessment in very, very concrete ways. Okay. So I want to know, and you need to ask yourself and be really, really honest with yourself, on a scale of 1 to 10, how is your general mood? If you are finding, so that's 1 to 10, 1 is terrible and 10 is wonderful. So if you are finding that you are consistently functioning at a 5 or less, it may be time to have both a physical as well as a mental health assessment that will help you to get to the bottom. We need to find out what is it that's going on, why you're feeling down, and more importantly, what steps that you need to take to begin to feel better. So what is that number? I know you're listening right now. What are you? Are you hopefully you're an 8 or 9, but if you find yourself not just for a week, but weeks and months, and some people for years, that you are really functioning at a 5 or less, it is really, really the time, and today is a new day, for you to take some new steps and figure out what's going on so that you can then begin to come up with a plan to begin to feel better. You know, some questions that I was, you know, thinking about, you know, we focus on our environment and our relationships. And of course, those are very, very important and critical to our well-being, or on the other hand, our lack of well-being. But could your medications be causing or exacerbating your depression or anxiety or your suicidal thoughts? Because our medications that rev up your body or brain, such as stimulants or antidepressants, are some of the most common medications. Now, listen to this, because I checked this out. I'm not pretending to be an MD, but I was reading about this yesterday, and that these stimulants, including antidepressants, are some of the most common medications that can actually cause more anxiety. And that's especially true if you've recently started taking a new, commonly known as steroid drugs. And they also come with side effects, especially with long-term use. And these include steroids, including symptoms such as swelling, high blood pressure, mood swings, and yes, anxiety. So we're not just looking at what is going on in our lives in terms of our relationships and our mental health, but we have to also look Could it be our food? Could it be the medications that we are taking that are either causing or contributing to our lack of well-being? But then, of course, okay, if you're saying, no, I'm not taking any pills, and the medicines that I am taking have been prescribed by my doctor, and they're needed, and they're not the problem. So then you have to ask yourself, is there something situational that is going on in your life, present or past, that is causing you distress? How are, again, the importance of assessment, your relationships with family, friends, your spouse, partner, or colleagues? And are any of these relationships, and you have to be honest with yourself, causing you stress or angst? And I see many men and women in my practice who have little, if any, support from friends or family. And it's often this feeling of loneliness. So it's not that their core group are making them crazy and causing them problems, but it is the loneliness and fear of the future that brings them into therapy in the first place. And what about work? Do you enjoy what you are doing? Can you honestly say, because we're looking at everything, our relationships, our physical health, our medicines, can you honestly say that you are happy doing what you're doing? Is your work in alignment with your values? Or is your work too one of the factors, one of the issues in your life that is causing you major stress? And if it is, again, what to do? A young patient of mine, a young man who's in his late 20s, went into the finance field. And we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. His stepfather was a big financial advisor, his father was in finances and tech. And what was so interesting in our conversation was that he told me he never wanted to go into tech, or he never wanted to go into finances. So I had asked him, I said, "So what did you want to do?" And he said, "Well, I really wanted to be a teacher, but I knew," this is what he said, "that my family would not be happy because I would not be making the kind of money, the kind of dollars that I would be making if I was in the finance world or the tech world." But he has been miserable, and it was so great that he was finally able to talk about this, and in his self-assessment was able to realize that he has been spending a lot of years doing something that is not aligned with his values. He wants to work with kids. So the homework for this young man was to go to a career counselor. So I'm going to be talking with him and meeting with him in a couple of days. And I'm very, very interested in hearing, what the conversation was like when he met with his career counselor, because it sounds like he is at a place in his life that he's not going to do more of the same, that is not working for him, and that is not in his best interest. So I asked him, because I know his dad. And I said, "What do you think the family is going to say?" And he says, "I worry that I am going to be disappointing them." And I said to him, I said, "Look, you can't live your life for your stepfather and your mom and your father. And at 29 years of age, how important it is that he figures out, better at this age rather than at 50 or 60, that he's in a career that he does absolutely not want to be in, and that he is willing, at least I hope, that he is going to take the steps, beyond seeing the career counselor, to get out of a field that he absolutely can't stand and move into an environment that he finds meaningful for him." And I think the kids, if he ends up becoming a teacher, will be very, very lucky to have somebody like him who is generous spirited and warm and sensitive. So we need to be honest with ourselves. This word honest comes up a lot. that we need to figure out, you know, what it is that we want, need, and what it is that we don't want to need. And this takes some time and some introspection so that we don't fool ourselves. We don't fool ourselves about our work, about our relationships, and about how we are living our lives. And finally, I have to ask you the question about money. Are you spending responsibly? I treat so many people who are in debt over their heads. They want the lifestyle. They want the persona that they are doing really, really well. And yet they are constantly, constantly stressed. Yet they still refuse to rein these habits in. So here it is, in summary, that whatever it is that is getting in the way of your peace and serenity, it's not worth, it's just not worth for you to continue to suffer. And again, don't hesitate to reach out for help. And I know that I sound like a broken record, but remind yourself again that we don't need to navigate life stressors on our own. So I'm really wondering what your ratings are. I hope that your ratings are high, but if they're not, as my late father used to say, today is a new day and you have an opportunity. We all have an opportunity every single day to change the path, to change the trajectory that we are on. Well, I have an unexpected guest today, and the guest is my husband, Jim Freddos, who is a sociologist and an activist and a criminologist, and he is the host of an amazing television show, which airs in New York and soon in the Hamptons and I think in other places as well come the fall. The Radical Imagination. And what happened was this morning, as I was getting ready to go and play tennis, as I typically do on Monday, that's how I start off my week. It is my mental health way of beginning every single Monday. And Jim gave me this article that was in the New York Times that I thought that would be a terrific article that we should talk about. Initially, he had wanted me to talk about this on his show, The Radical Imagination, but I thought, you know what? I want to talk about this first of all on the Ask Beanie show. So since he is here in our apartment in New York City, I thought it would be an interesting conversation to have. So let me give you a little background. This is an article and a letter that is sent to a columnist, and the column is called The Ethicist, okay? And The Ethicist is written by a man whose name is Kwame Anthony Appiah. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And he answers questions from readers who are asking questions, more ethical questions, not so much self-help, but ethical questions of really what to do. So today's column, the headline is, "My Father Was Abusive. Should I Attend His Memorial Service?" So the real question became, what to do when a toxic parent passes away. And I hope you've never been in this situation, but unfortunately, I'm sure many people have. So let me give you just a little bit of background, and then Jim and I are going to have a conversation. And by the way, Jim, thank you very, very much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you. It's not totally unexpected, but I hope you'll still come on my show. But
I will come on your show. And what's really great is having
a husband who's about this article.
A sociologist, yes. Is that we are continually talking and debating issues. Ethical issues and political issues. So it is usually a lot of fun. So here's the backstory here. I am the adult child of an explosive, intolerant, narcissistic father who found gratification in his harsh treatment of me throughout my childhood and adolescence. I was terrified by his beatings and constant bellowing, and over time he settled into an easy contempt for me. Although I witnessed him abuse my siblings too, my father focused his abuse on me, his firstborn. He died a few months ago. In his final years, I emerged from estrangement to help my siblings understand his complicated medical situations. I mean, that's amazing that he would want to have anything to do with any of this. But in his final months, the father admitted his enduring cruel treatment of me to his sister and one of my siblings. And after years of denying and justifying his abuse, he left his last recorded words in a voicemail message to me saying, "I'll never get over my struggles to apologize to you." My father was financially generous, well, good for him, supporting our education, homes, and families. My siblings catered to him, and how interesting was that? These are my comments until the end. And now they are organizing a memorial for him, in quotes, for the children. As the memorial approaches, a sibling of mine expressed concern that I would be triggered and upset the children. My father's prim octogenarian sister cautioned me against attending, seeming more out of fear of my presence, absolutely, than concern for my well-being. These family members fear the truth of my experience, which would threaten their facade and their denial of his cruelty, which is all in service to the decorum of, in quotes, a good family. I am grateful, he goes on to say, I'm grateful for the love and support of my wife and children, and I want to be present with them for the memorial. And so he should. Attending the memorial to witness the lore and mythology will help my understanding of the family. How do I be present with my wife and children at my family's loyal memorial to my abusive father? How can an abuser be honored or memorialized? And the silence about child abuse is deafening, and the name was withheld. So, Jim,
yes.
What is your reaction to this?
Wow. Well, there's so much to unpack there. And I could just feel your audience and their brains whirring around to put what you just said within the context of different experiences, probably, but also within the dynamics of their family structure. So this is pretty common stuff. The dynamics of family gets very complicated, and there's all kinds of issues there. But let's dive in. It so happened, as you know, interestingly, that I had my own show on last night, and it coincided with our tennis watching too. So I'm still trying to get over my Carlos's Alcaraz's loss there. I really love this guy, but anyway, all right, I'm working through that. But the interesting thing is that I had Jim Gilligan, the psychiatrist, on, and it's at the same time that this the tennis was on. So he speaks so much about some of the things that are going on there. So I'd like to sort of speak in a way through that understanding, his observations on this issue. So let me, you ask me what you think. And
well, I'd like to make a couple of comments.
Absolutely,
here,
go ahead.
Because I underlined a lot of things that were in this article. So here again, in this father's final months, he admitted his enduring cruel treatment of me to his sister and one of my siblings. This father didn't even have the wherewithal and the, I would say, the empathy, the caring to sit down directly with his son. Well, good for him that he spoke about this with his sister and with one of his other children. But where was he? He should have sat down with his son and apologized profusely and given his son an opportunity to respond rather than simply leave a voicemail. Mm. You know, he let himself saying that I'll never get over my struggles to apologize to you. I think it was a poor apology. It was an apology, but it was not a great apology.
However, could I just say that this individual, this son here, has done a remarkable job against all kinds of odds of overcoming this. And he's miles ahead of other members of his family in dealing with this. I think he's on the road to healing. He has an awareness. And yes, I agree with you. The father did not do right by him. He should have more than just an email at the end. But still, this young man, if he is a young man, really is making enormous progress and is way ahead of the other members of his family in terms of getting on with his life and doing what's best for him.
Well, he's certainly asking all of the right questions, but the real issue here, you know, not only, you know, should I attend his memorial service, which is something that he asks the ethicist, which he says that he absolutely wants to do. Mm-hmm. But the question for me then becomes, Jim, what should he do at this memorial service? And my gut reaction, and it would be interesting to hear what you have to say and what listeners are also thinking. And of course, you can always call us at 888-874-4888. Perhaps he should read something along all of these beautiful things that are probably going to be said about his father. There has to be something on balance. I think this is a time. I think this is a place to be able to say, my father, yes, he was financially generous, supporting our education, the homes and the families. However, there was another part of my father in this service that needs to be acknowledged.
So I think that would be appropriate and just also say that, you know, amidst all of this, that I still love him. And there were up to him to say what he wants to say. Although I believe the ethicist said not to say. The ethicist said he should write something, perhaps. Right, okay.
Perhaps the real question becomes, Jim, what is it that this man needs to do? He says he wants to go to this memorial service with his wife and children. Okay, that's his decision. But what does he then want to do at the service?
Now, what do you think? He wants to go. So what do you think he wants to do by doing that for himself?
I think that he probably is not sure whether or not he, alongside everybody else, is going to be talking about these wonderful things about his abusive father.
But he sounds sure that he wants to go.
He does want to go.
So I know
to go.
Ask him, but what do you think?
I think he should go, and I think that he should entertain. It's not something that I say to him, you need to do this or you should do this. I think he should need to entertain whether or not his siblings and other family members will be getting up and talking about this man's great generosity in terms of money and houses and education. He needs to think about whether he needs to or wants to stand up and say, yes, my father was generous in certain ways, but there was a part of him that we as a family need to acknowledge and recognize.
But that's your opinion, could be many, many others' opinion, but doesn't the real opinion that count is his? Well, now, if he wants to do that, fine, but he has to be the one to listen to, I think, in terms of his take and narrative and what he thinks he needs to do and so on. And
it's a conversation. I would love to have this conversation with this particular man, because the ethicist is saying, yes, you're going to learn a lot about your family, which of course he already has probably learned that they are in denial and avoidance about the reality of who his father, you know, really was in terms of being a violent, abusive parent.
Well, that's why I brought in Jim Gilligan, because Jim's work, as you well know, is about healing. Jim went through an abusive situation himself in his own family, and his older brother and so on. So he used that information, that narrative, to construct a lifetime of work, of clinical work, dealing with people who have been hurt and abused. And in the final analysis, it's about learning to transform oneself. The hate, the anger only makes things worse. The morality, this was calling these people evil and horrible and this, that, doesn't get us very far in that process. So that's why I'm saying this young man sounds like he's well on the way of healing himself. He's doing a good job. Does he have everything in place? No. But I think, again, he's turning this anger, this hate into something that can be productive for him. And because it doesn't get us anywhere in our desire for revenge and for constant lambasting of people and hatred.
Well, we don't know at all, what he is actually wanting to do other than attend the memorial service. Now, this ethicist said, well, he says, maybe you would like to write something to the family. Well, maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he wants to stand up at the service. But these are the kinds of questions that I think a responsible person who answered this letter, the ethicist, should have really posed. Not telling him what he should and shouldn't do, but asking him and giving him a number of options of how does he want to deal with the reality of his father, even though this is going to be a memorial service.
Well, whether it's you or the other members of the family or the ethicist or whoever else, as again, I'm bringing Jim's work into it, when he ran the mental health services and Department of Mental Hygiene in the state of Massachusetts, the first thing to do, and I think you know that as a good therapist too, is to listen to the person, the narrative. So let's at first hear from this fellow and what he makes of this and what his take is before we even begin to discuss possible options.
Well, he makes a very, very important statement in the letter that he sent to the ethicist. Mm-hmm. He says, and this is really the central question, at least for me, Jim, is how can an abuser, okay? The guy was an abuser. His father was a violent abuser. So how can an abuser be honored and memorialized at a service as if none of this actually happened?
Well, again, we don't know what happened at this memorial. Perhaps other members of the family did not do that either. I mean, we don't know what occurred. It's a complicated dynamic. So I think it's an excellent point that's being made in the letter here, that the other members of the family, the sister and so sibling, have used this as a mechanism to not deal with their brother's anger. And I think that's very important.
And pain. Right.
So everybody needs to still deal with that.
Or not.
Or not, yes. That means they've got to either repress it or remain angry and hostile. And again, why bring in Gilligan over and over again here? Because we have a country and a world full of people we're walking around who are feeling angry and hateful, and we can't keep going on like this. We're going to destroy each other, and it hurts us too as individuals. So that's why we need to find other ways of dealing with that anger and pain to transform it into something that can be healing for all concerned.
Well, okay,
if possible.
There are a couple of sentences in this letter. He says that a sibling of mine expressed concern that I would be triggered and upset. And then
it's very condescending, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then the father's sister cautioned me against attending, seemingly, and he's right on, more out of fear of his presence than concern for his well-being.
They haven't dealt with their own feelings on this.
These skeletons in the closet have gone on, apparently, for all of his life. I mean, this is an adult man with a wife and children. So this is old news that the family, certainly his siblings, knew because they were also abused by the father. Yeah. And yet, nobody up to this point seems, of course, we don't know whether the siblings were in therapy or whatever, have been upfront with one another about the reality of who this father was, despite the fact he paid for their education and their houses.
I have confidence in this fellow, and his capacity and his ability to either in written form or perhaps in oral form or have some sort of conversation. I have confidence that he will be able to do this. And that's my gut feeling, but one never knows until one really actually meets these people and sees what happens. But again, I see this guy is certainly the healthiest of, right? You agree? Okay.
I do. And right. I think he demonstrates his mental health in having had the chutzpah to write to the ethicist to get a second opinion, a second take about what would be in his best interest.
He's a very sensitive
Very, very sensitive soul. And I know that you and I, we disagree on this. I think that there are some crimes, whatever the crimes are, that are unforgivable, and I, as we talked about earlier today, that as long as they don't interfere with the quality of our well-being and our relationships and our day-to-day life, etc., that I don't feel that reconciliation and redemption
healing to Quinlan
is necessary in order to be able for our being able to live a happy
life. Well, we pay a price to not do that, I would point out. And I think, again, I understand your point, but I still would say that the answer really is in developing a love that transcends all of this. This is what Gilgan is saying, both for our own sake, people who have been abused, have been hurt, and for those who've done the hurting. And that's what I would say to that. It's about creating a world, creating individuals, family structures, where we learn how this comes about so that we can prevent it.
Okay. Now, what I have found in treating hundreds and hundreds of survivors of early child sexual abuse, okay, so I would not, I don't know whether you heard my comments, that I made a choice years ago to not deal and to not treat the perpetrators, okay? Right or wrong, that was my decision, and I wouldn't do it. I had my hands full with the kids and the adults who were sexually abused as children. And what I found in my treatment, in my clinical treatment, that forgiveness was not necessary in order for the kids and the adults who had been abused to be able to move on with their lives.
You don't have to forgive. I agree with you. You don't forgive necessarily the act, but the person. There is always this redemptive possibility in all of us. And I think in terms, you have had individuals, haven't you, tried to bring them into therapy, abusive individuals who are brought in to discuss, not necessarily you're treating them.
Not with sexual abuse. No, I would never bring the perpetrators in with the people.
Or see them privately?
I wouldn't see the perpetrators at all.
What if you're
And I think Gilligan would be upset with me if he heard me say this.
What if your patient wanted
would be their decision.
I agree.
My decision, it wouldn't be.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you might find asking them might surprise you. They may say, yes, please do. I would like you to be there in this process. So you would do that then.
I would do it, but all in 55 years, it's never happened. Nobody who is in.
Have you asked them?
I haven't asked them.
You haven't?
No, I haven't asked them, but there was never a desire to come face to face.
Maybe they never saw that as a possibility. Maybe they're too scared. Life springs eternal, and we are on a new season here.
Yeah.
Although I'm going to be, as you know, depressed with the end of summer. You'll help me. Well, we still got a couple more months of good weather. All right, yes.
That's actually true. But again, I know Jim Gilligan's work. I mean, he's renowned around the world, and his area is violent. I understand all of that. But all I can say, though, is in treating the survivors of crimes, and specifically sexual abuse, forgiveness has not been necessary at all in order for them to go on with their lives.
Listen, I think that you're dealing with some of the most difficult situations of people I admire, respect so much, your tenacity, your patience, your wisdom that you bring to it. As you well know, I couldn't do it. So I
get society.
Well, I do things another way. Social movements is enough for me. But anyway, I respect and admire and love what you try to do with all the people that you do come in contact with. I know that they appreciate it as well.
Well, I wish that I had this man's name.
Well,
I would write him. Of course, he specifically asked to have his name withheld in the New York Times.
Maybe write something then and send it to the ethicist. At least maybe. Give him that possibility, that choice.
Maybe.
With your address.
I think that, one of the shows that I did a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about ambivalent relationships, and it was a Dr. Grant who had done an incredible amount of research. And, his point was, and I completely agree, that if relationships are horrible, at least you know that they're horrible and they're always horrible, and that it's these ambivalent relationships that are the most toxic. They are the most,
right.
Well, who wants to deal with them? We don't want to be on a roller coaster ride with our relationships.
But in any relationship, including those between countries and different peoples and cultures and communities, there is by definition going to be a certain amount of ambivalence. So we've got to deal with that ambiguity, that ambivalence, if we're going to move forward, it seems to me. And you're right, it is very difficult. So,
well, I like to know on a day-to-day basis pretty much how you or people in my life are going to respond. I don't want to be on a ride. I want to have a pretty consistent day-to-day existence with the people who are close to me.
Same here.
Yes.
And I hope I'm doing that as best.
We're doing great.
Okay.
Well, listen, thank you so much again. My husband, Jim Freddo's host of The Radical Imagination, for your input. I think this was a good conversation. And it's
2:00,
and I have to end the show, and I'll see you soon. So listen, everybody, I don't know what you thought about this dialogue with my husband, Jim Freddo's, about this situation. It's an interesting situation. I wish that we could have had an opportunity, all of you who are listening to dialogue about this. Well, again, it's 3:57 Eastern Standard Time here in extremely hot and humid New York City. And I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. The first, of course, is that we have to do everything, and that means everything in our power to figure out ways that we can live our lives in ways that are really in our best interest and get rid of all the toxicity in our lives, if it is possible, because toxicity, not only food, but people in these relationships, they can kill us one way or the other. And of course, the second is that we all need to, this is apropos what my husband is saying, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to understand and accept and love each other. So again, thank you so much for listening, as you do every single week here on the Ask Beattie Show. And I hope you have a really good rest of the day and a good week. And I will talk with you next week and every single week for the next 100 years, hopefully, here on the Ask Beattie Show.
US Open coming
on
up,
the
right?
Progressive Radio Network. US Open is tomorrow.
Yes.
I'm going to the grounds. I'm hoping to meet Coco Gauff.
And I'm hoping Alcaraz will beat Djokovic this time.
Well, I'm with you on that. So, again, goodbye, everybody. Have a good day. Be well. And we'll talk next week. Bye-bye.